You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin is home to 9 of the 22 baseball teams in the Northwoods League. And with college players coming from around the country, they depend on local families to host them for the summer. We'll talk with a Green Bay couple about what it's like sharing their homes with the players. Now, Vice President Kamala Harris made a trip to the U.S.-Mexico border on Friday, touring a port of entry and a Border Patrol processing facility in El Paso. And today, former President Trump and Texas Governor Greg Abbott made an appearance together to promote the construction of more sections of a border wall. The political attention comes as immigration authorities continue to see high numbers of people coming into the country. In May, more than 180,000 people were apprehended while trying to cross the border. Thousands of immigrants seeking asylum are still in federal custody. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about what's happening at the border now and what the Biden administration is doing? What would you like to see done to deal with the rise in immigration? Would you like to see Congress work on legislation to reform the immigration system? If you or someone in your family has immigrated to the U.S., love to hear about your experience and what you think. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dara Lind is a reporter covering immigration policy for ProPublica. Dara, welcome back to Central Time. Dara, when we talked to you back in March, border crossings and people in detention were pretty high. How have things moved since then?
So there's been a continued increase in the number of people who Border Patrol agents have caught crossing into the U.S. That is not that most of those people are still, remember, being turned away immediately and sent back to Mexico or back to their home countries under the public health order that's referred to as Title 42 under the section of the U.S. code that allowed the CDC to do this. That was put in place by the Trump administration. It's still in place now for most people crossing into the U.S. The Biden administration has started making some noise about potentially scaling that back as they take the position that the U.S. has turned the corner on the coronavirus pandemic. But there hasn't been any kind of wide scale official action. There are like little exemptions being built in here and there. So while the number of people, well, you know, the top line number of apprehensions is way above even what we saw in 2019, if you look at the number of people who are actually, you know, if you try to do an apples to apples comparison, we're not there. And that means that things like, you know, Border Patrol, border processing facilities, that immigration detention are not at kind of the strained point that they were in 2019 or even in even earlier this year, as the Biden administration has like has kind of continued to keep these interim facilities for children in particular to alleviate the crunch at the border there. So that resource and pipeline issue that was really the crux of the border crisis as it was being described in February and March is less of a problem now. But those top line numbers, because they're still high, are creating an easy opportunity to, you know, to raise the question, to raise the idea that something unusual is going on, which it is, right? The Title 42 order is certainly unusual, but raising the kind of specter that all of these people are being allowed to get into the U.S., which they are very much not.
Right. To be clear, Dara, if I have this right anyway, that person who maybe came up from Central America, they're turned back under that COVID policy. They don't have the opportunity to start the asylum process. Do I have that right?
Right. That is the big difference between what standard immigration law says is supposed to happen and what this Title 42 policy does. And so the, you know, the argument during the Trump administration was that asylum was a loophole, right? That an immigrant who wanted to come into the U.S. could just tell a Border Patrol agent, I want asylum, and they would be allowed to stay in the U.S. indefinitely. The Title 42 policy closes, you know, if that's a loophole, it's closed by this policy. So now we're talking about just the, you know, if the number of apprehensions is a concern now, that is only justifiable based on the idea that people should somehow be prevented from even setting foot on U.S. soil, not from concerns that they're being, that someone who is apprehended by Border Patrol is then being allowed to stay.
And now how about kids in particular, unaccompanied minors or accompanied minors for that matter? The Biden administration said, hey, we're going to treat them differently than the Trump administration. What has happened in practice?
So as far as unaccompanied minors are concerned, they are being allowed to stay in the United States and seek legal status. That is kind of what caused the real pipeline issue that we were seeing earlier this spring, because there weren't the facilities to, you know, safely house those kids. The Biden administration's response has been to spin up a bunch of federally run interim, you know, influx care facilities. Many of those, some of those are kind of scheduled to come offline in coming weeks, but the even just having something in operation for a few months, that can be a very long time for a child. And the safety corners that they, you know, that they had to cut, or the things that they kind of abrogated in order to spin these facilities up quickly, are now beginning to become a concern. At Fort Bliss, which is one of the biggest facilities where kids are being held, there have been lots of concerns that kids aren't getting necessary psychological care, that they just feel that they're being abandoned there, that they're kind of warehoused. And this is something that a lot of advocates and former officials were raising as concerns when the facilities got spun up, because they were saying, if you don't build in minimum safety and health standards now, you're going to find a point where these influx facilities are around longer than you want them to be, and then it's going to be too late. And so while it does look like the Biden administration has been able to speed the rate at which kids are being placed with relatives and therefore out of federal custody entirely, there definitely is a concern about the way that they've chosen to fix that problem.
Talking to Dara Lind, reporter covering immigration policy for ProPublica, looking at the latest news from the U.S.-Mexico border. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your own experiences at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jody is with us in Downing. Jody, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Jody?
So many issues here. I work with in two nonprofits in Guatemala. And I know why people are coming to the U.S., and it's poverty and starvation and lack of jobs. But, you know, what I really wanted to talk about is the importance of, if there was policy that made it easy for the farms to get farm workers, these people would not have to come up illegally. And we need the workforce. And so I'm really a proponent for helping the DACA, the Dreamer kids, get legal status. And I'm really a proponent for expanding the farm program so that we can bring up temporary workers, because these people want to work. We need the work. And they want to go home. And they can't go home when they come across the border undocumented.
Jody, thanks a lot for the call. Dara, Jody gives us a lot to work with. First of all, her point, her case for more legal opportunities for people to come up and work in the country, as an alternative to coming in illegal ways. Is that something people are talking about now?
It's certainly something that the Biden administration has on its kind of nice to have list. The problem with this is that expanding legal immigration is mostly something that only Congress can do. Unlike comparable countries like Canada, there isn't a lot of executive branch flexibility in that regard. So the Biden administration says, yes, we want Congress to pass a broad immigration reform. And that's about as far as they can go. They have taken a little bit of executive authority to expand the number of non-farm temporary work visas, and they've actually earmarked a bunch of those for Northern Triangle, which is Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, the countries that have been kind of the biggest, that have seen the biggest rise in over the last half decade in unauthorized migration to the U.S. They have earmarked for those nationals. They have a little bit more flexibility in that regard, as far as I understand it, than they do in farm work. But the problem here is that as the conditions in these countries get more and more dire, the prospect of being able to come temporarily but then having to go back isn't necessarily as appealing as it might have once been. And so there are, you know, the idea of kind of restoring what academics call circular migration, the kind of work migration we had in the middle of the 20th century, when it was fairly easy to come in the U.S., work for, you know, a couple of years and then go back. It's not super clear that that is what we would see if
it were much easier to come work temporarily. There are going to be people who are going to want to live in the U.S. because it's safer, and that's where the hard policy issues come in.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Dara Lind, immigration reporter for ProPublica, getting an update on the situation at the southern border after a visit from Vice President Harris. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What fixes, if any, do you think our immigration system needs? Are you worried about the situation in detention centers along the border, about the number of people trying to make it to claim asylum at the southern border? Do you have any hope that Congress will be able to reach agreements on immigration? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our talk now with Dara Lind, immigration reporter for ProPublica, looking at the latest developments along the U.S.-Mexico border. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your hopes for changes in the laws if you'd like to see them, your questions for our guest. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's go back to your calls now. Tom is with us in Sheboygan. Tom, hi.
Good afternoon.
What do you want to bring up, Tom?
Well, I don't want to come across as the fact of not having empathy, not having compassion, especially for the young children that are coming across our border. But I'm just trying to figure out, what is the end game here? How are we going to afford this? How are we going to sustain this? Both the previous administration and the current administration have had arguments over, can we afford to have a $300 or a $600 stipend on unemployment? Can we afford to do $600 or $1,400 stimulus? And at what, who's considered rich and who can afford this, and what can we pay for that afford to do our rent during the pandemic and our mortgage forbearance. And it's always the, what can we afford to do? What can we afford to do? What can we afford to do? And yet we're talking about mental health of children that are not citizens.
I gotcha. Tom, thanks a lot for the call. Dara, what is this costing the U.S., these border enforcement efforts, housing, asylum seekers, and so forth?
So this is definitely a good question, and it's one that we don't have a great answer to. The office in the Department of Health and Human Services that is responsible for the care of migrant children, doesn't have a massive emergency budget to spin up these kind of emergency care facilities. And so there definitely have been questions. The administration has, on the one hand, maintained that it doesn't need to ask Congress for more funds for the year. And on the other hand, when it said that it was wasn't going to be as aggressive as then candidate Biden promised in terms of resettling refugees who were processed abroad, the argument that they gave at one point there was that they had needed to spend this money on housing on unaccompanied children. We're not talking about anything on the magnitude of, sending out unemployment checks to hundreds of millions of to tens of millions of Americans or anything like that. But it's a concern more about, transparency and the questions of whether this kind of emergency influx response is the best stance, because everyone ideally believes that that children shouldn't be in government custody for any sustained period of time, that they should be with their relatives, and therefore, that also has the benefit of not costing the government as much. But the question of whether cut too many corners in screening potential relative sponsors and therefore run the risk that, someone could be, that you could be releasing kids into danger is not necessarily, justified by the budget alone. So there definitely are questions about kind of how this is being paid for, but it's not, we're talking about at most 10,
tens of thousands of kids or 10,000 kids at any one time, and really a lot less than that at this point. So it's not the most, it's not, you know, we're not talking about trillions of dollars here.
Thanks for the call, Tom. We'll go now to Tim calling from Northern Wisconsin. Tim, hi.
Hey, so in your last couple of minutes, I was listening to your show for the first time, and I think that we in the media, there is a clear and present messaging discrepancy that is causing a lot of this situation. And I want to know, why is it that during the Trump administration, shows like this and the media portrayed these, as you were talking about them a couple of minutes ago, children's migration housing facilities or whatever you're calling them now. A year and 2 years ago, they were kids in cages. And now you're putting a bunch of fluff on this and calling it something different. It's not a crisis now. Now it's a humanitarian effort rather than kids in cages. And let's be clear, the Biden administration, on their first week in office, I believe it was, when they overturned the Remain in Mexico policy, this was a clear message to everyone south of the border: come on, America is open. And I believe that the Biden administration has of these children on their hands that are crossing the Darien, I believe it's the Darien Straits and the jungles and the trip up here where 10 to 15% of these people are dying on this journey. This is a clear failure of the Biden administration to.
Tim, I gotcha. Couple points there. First of all, Dara, I mean, kids in cages under the Trump administration, something different now. Are conditions basically the same as Tim is suggesting?
I mean, I personally have never used the term kids in cages for exactly this reason. It obscures more than it reveals, right? And these facilities are definitely a thing that the Trump administration also used and that did meet with some pressure from activists and Democrats at that point. But frankly, a lot of those same activists and Democrats have also been very frustrated with the Biden administration's use of this. There's less political pressure now than there was when they were first spinning up these facilities in February. But there were a couple of sites actually that the Biden administration was considering putting facilities and ended up not doing so because there was this pressure from local activists not to. But you know, it's also flatly not true that ending the Remain in Mexico program changed the current border situation, because most people weren't being enrolled in the Remain in Mexico program when Biden came into office. Most people were being expelled under the public health order, which is exactly what they still are. So the idea that that despite the fact that current U.S. policy is to turn people back, a message has been sent that the U.S. is open isn't. I'm not saying that that's not an understanding that some people have, but it does. It's not a reflection of the U.S. actually changing its policy. It's in this very tricky realm where it's really hard to tell, you know, smuggler misinformation from word of mouth, from, you know, misunderstandings about when things are going to open up.
Tim, thanks for the call. We'll go to Obed now in Green Bay. Obed, hi.
Hey, big fan of the show. I'm kind of just want to say a few things. I'm a DACA recipient myself. I was an undocumented immigrant till I believe 2011 when Barack Obama had the deferred action for childhood arrival. I honestly feel like as somebody that went through it all, on one hand, I understand that there's only a certain number of people that the country can sustain. But, you know, my parents came to this country and they risked everything just to give my sister and I a better life. I feel that most Americans don't really even understand how the immigration system even works. You know, it's easy for people to say, get in line, do it the right way, but what is the right way? Do they even understand how the immigration system works? How do you apply for a visa? What the process of getting a green card to become a citizen? And I'll just take my comments out there. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for sharing your story. And Dara, that question about to get in line, what is the line? How easy is it to immigrate legally into the United States.
I mean, it continues to be true until some, you know, major legislation from Congress that that there are two main ways to do that, one of which is, you know, getting a work permit, which, as, you know, the previous caller mentioned, there's just so much more demand than supply. And the other is having a relative who's already in the U.S. and is a citizen. That depends on categories, but people from the countries that have historically sent the most, or that have in recent memory sent the most immigrants to the U.S. are dealing with very, very long delays. If you add to that the fact that U.S. laws that were passed in the, you know, largely in the mid 1990s made it much, much, much harder to become legal if you'd ever been unauthorized in the U.S., what you ended up with was, as the first caller mentioned, a scenario in which once you're in the U.S. without authorization, the safest thing you could do would be to kind of hunker down and stay and settle. And so we continue to have, you know, for the most part, this extremely long resident, extremely settled, unauthorized population. And that's something that's very easy to lose track of when we're talking about the, you know, the news cycles about the border, is that these have not been in large enough numbers to really shift the baseline of what the unauthorized immigrant population in the U.S. looks like. We're still talking about overwhelmingly people who have been here for a decade or longer. And the more that the question of some kind of legalization or amnesty gets caught up in the politics of, well, if we do anything for people already here, then it's going to send a message to the border, the harder it is for, you know, the more those people just end up getting caught in the middle and victims of a politics that they have no control over.
Thanks for that call. And Dara, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
Dara Lind is a reporter covering immigration policy at ProPublica. She joined us for a look at what's happening at the U.S.-Mexico border after recent high-profile political visits there. Coming up, we're approaching the halfway point of the Northwoods League regular season. We'll find out what it's like being a host family for baseball players. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out why a lot of emergency rooms around the country are operated by private equity financial companies. Now, maybe you've spent some time this summer taking in a baseball game or two or more. Wisconsin is well represented in the Northwoods League with 9 of its 22 teams. They are in Wausau, Wisconsin Rapids, Fond du Lac, La Crosse, Kenosha, Green Bay, Eau Claire, Madison, and Mequon. It's a summer league for college players from around the country. It's considered to be one of the best in the nation. Some of the players have gone on to become major league all-stars like Max Scherzer, Chris Sale, and Ben Zobrist, to name a few. Because they're so far from home, the athletes often live with local families during the season. So we thought we'd invite a host family on the show and find out what it's like. Ted and Jenny Sorosek are husband and wife in Green Bay. This is their 5th year hosting players. Jenny, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And Ted, thanks for being with us.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for having us.
Well, Ted, what made you decide to get into the game of hosting baseball players?
Well, Jenny and I are huge sports fans. We are season ticket holders for the Packers, and we only have one daughter. And so we wanted to really give her an experience that she could have where she has a sibling-type person living with her and a role model, but at the same time get to see sports in a different general look because she's a big soccer fan.
And Jenny, what do you do for these Green Bay? Well, it used to be the Green Bay Bullfrogs. Now you got the Green Bay Booyah. What do you provide as a host family for them?
We offer them anything that they want to eat while they're here. And that really varies from season to season, depending on the guys that we have, definitely. And then they each get, we host 2 guys each summer and we have 2 spare rooms. So they get their own room. We have an extra living room that they can hang out in, and we just try and make them as welcome as they can in Green Bay.
Now, these are Jenny young athlete guys. How much food are they going through?
Oh my goodness. The first year that we had this, I had no idea. Cause like Ted said, we just have a daughter, and at that time she was only 5. So not eating all that much at all. And I was floored at how much our first player ate. But now, being our 5th season, we're a little bit more used to that.
And Ted, what's it like? You're getting to meet people from all over the country, right?
It is awesome. I mean, we have guys from Vegas. We've had our two this year from Georgia and Kentucky. So it's really interesting when you sit down with them and talk about what goes on in their part of the country, what they've lived through, you know, how they played baseball growing up. It's just an experience that you really can't replicate.
And Jenny, I've seen some Northwoods League games, but I understand, you know, when you see it up close and personal, these guys have a pretty grueling schedule, right?
Oh, they do. They're playing every day, sometimes twice a day. As you guys know, our weather lately has been a little wet. So they've had several doubleheaders. So they're gone quite a bit. But it gives them an idea of what the minor leagues might be like if they do get drafted.
Ted, do you stay in touch with some of the players, you know, from previous years?
Yep, some more than others. We've had a lot of the guys are on different contracts. Some get a 10-day contract, some get 30, and some get a full season. So some of the guys we get to know much better than others. Some we've kept in contact with. The guys who have been closer in the last couple of years, we've been in contact with more. Some of the other guys, you know, who hadn't been here very long just said thank you, and that was about all we've heard from them.
Jenny, with these tough schedules, do you get time to hang out with these guys that much and show them around to give them a taste of Wisconsin?
We do. At the beginning of the season, they typically come in a few days before the season starts, so we have a little bit more time there. And then they have three off days throughout the season. There's an all-star break if they don't get to make that. So we try and bring them down to a Brewer game so that they get that experience of being at a different stadium on those off days.
Ted, you mentioned off the top, you are big sports fans already. Does having, you know, this personal connection with the players on the Green Bay Booyah make you feel more connected with the team?
It does. You know, when you go to a game, all of a sudden we sit right behind home plate, so you start to get to know the players a little bit better. My daughter and I were on the field for one of those activities in between innings, and after it, our player came up and thanked us and was smiling and laughing at our efforts. So it's nice to see, and it's really good for Josephine to get to know these players on a different level. They'll say hi to her. She's walking by the dugout or walking up in the concourse, so it really makes her feel good too.
Now, Jenny, they're up here for baseball season, so these aren't guys from Georgia experiencing a Wisconsin winter. But what kind of things, I don't know, are different or new for them in Wisconsin if they're here for the first time?
Well, our first player that we had was from New York City, and he kept commenting about how green everything was and there was grass because it was a totally different experience. And another thing that I hadn't even thought of before we started this was that their life experience was so different from what we've lived. So that particular player didn't have a driver's license because it wasn't necessary in New York. But that's not something we could easily get away with here.
And Ted, how would you sell other people on maybe being host families for these college players in the Northwoods League?
It's just a great experience to get to know some of these players on a more personal level. When you go to a game, you get to see a guy at bat, and you've already known their story. We have not had a bad experience with any of our players so far. They're so genuine. They're so nice. They're personable. The parents are so appreciative of what you do. The Green Bay Booyah as a ball club is so appreciative of what we do. And it's just a great experience to get to know these players and get to see what they're like.
And Jenny, as we wrap up, I think, you know, a lot of people, their sports radar might just extend to the major leagues. Could you talk about what you like about seeing a Northwoods League game?
Well, they're very entertaining. These guys actually, I hadn't thought about this before. One of our players this year said that they actually practice with a wooden bat so that they can get used to that, so they have the experience, but that it's a totally different game with a wooden bat versus their metal bat. So it's nice to see.
We'll leave it there. Jenny, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
And Ted, thanks for sharing this with us.
Well, absolutely. Thank you for having us.
Ted and Jenny Sorosik, our husband and wife in Green Bay. We talked to them about what it's like being a host family for baseball players on the Green Bay Booyah and previously the Bullfrogs Northwoods League team. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about leaving home and finding a new one.
In the mid-1970s, Lisa Chutow and her family had to leave their whole world behind, their farm, their friends, their home. They lived in northwest Laos, and the horrors of war were creeping in, so they started walking and ended up in a refugee camp. In the 1980s, Lisa moved to Eau Claire and raised her family there. She shares that experience in this essay, which is read by her daughter, Yia Lor.
When I walk along the Chippewa River, I'm reminded of another river in a place I once called home. Although thousands of miles away, Guqingdao, I have not forgotten the dirt path I walked to fetch water. I have not forgotten the stream that followed me to the garden. I have not forgotten my Hmong village in Laos. When it happened, I was too young and didn't know what to make of it. What child can piece together the meaning of war? My family lived in Sayanbuli province. We were farmers and knew little about the world outside our village or the war that had begun before I was ever born. One December night in 1974, some relatives came to say they were leaving. The war was coming. They tell you that. Despite this news, my family stayed. We cut trees to prepare for our garden. We burned the land and planted rice. We were farmers after all. Then in April of 1975, many Hmong people came to rest along the road by our house. They carried with them their belongings and they delivered the same message. We cannot stay. We must go. The war is here. I was 9 at the time. My parents handed me my 2-year-old sister and asked that I carry her while they carry the rest of our belongings. Whatever we could not bring would be left behind. I tried to carry my sister but could not. My parents handed me some belongings instead, but they were too heavy. Feeling the weight of the world on my shoulders, I cried. I cried because I could not carry my sister. I cried because I could not carry our belongings. And I cried because I could not carry the life I only knew. We left our village with hundreds of other Hmong people and never looked back. The paths in the jungles that we walked had already been paved by the hundreds that came before us. As we carried on, we cried. In October of 1976, we finally crossed the border into Thailand. It was in a refugee camp where I spent the rest of my youth trying to make sense of my past and look to the future. It was also here where I married my husband. One day, he suggested we apply for resettlement. We had an 11-month-old son and decided we would go for our little family. We would go for those who have yet to come. With that decision, we became names and numbers written on a chalkboard, paperwork filed away, a statistic, the aftermath of war, perhaps the forgotten. Then in 1987, we were sponsored by a Catholic diocese and left behind the land we first called home, a place where we played as kids, farmed and fell in love, and witnessed the death of those waiting for freedom. America became my new home, and Wisconsin's snow-covered hills and cornfields replaced the jungles and rice fields of Laos. I have tried to find my Hmong village on a map, but it is not labeled like Eau Claire. The river that ran through it is not drawn with a thin blue line like the Chippewa River. Perhaps my village and its river no longer exist, but Guching Yaw. I remember the dirt path I walked to feed our chickens and pigs. I remember the teapot we used to boil water from the stream. Thousands of miles and over 50 years later, Guching Yaw.
That was Eau Claire writer Yia Lor reading an essay written by her mother, Lisa Chu Tao, who also lives in Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, a health reporter explains why so many private equity firms own emergency room practices and what that means for patients. That's coming up next here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Private equity firms buy up companies with the hope of later selling them for a profit. In the last decade, a trend has emerged among those private equity firms buying emergency room staffing companies and other healthcare businesses. We're talking now about what happens when private equity firms get into the healthcare business. Margot Sanger-Katz is a domestic correspondent for the New York Times, where she writes about healthcare. Margot, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm guessing most people are like me, and when we go into a clinic or an emergency room, hopefully not too often, we don't think this might be owned by this financial investment firm. How common is this?
It's fairly common in emergency rooms. So in general, around the country, most doctors are either employed by the hospital where they work or they are part of a private practice, you know, group of doctors that are basically small business owners and run their own medical practice, and they practice sometimes in the office and sometimes in a hospital. But what we've seen in the last few years is that a growing number of those private practices have been purchased by these big investment firms that are kind of bundling them up together and running more and more practices around the country. And there are various reasons why they seem to be doing this. One is that I think there are some advantages of scale in terms of just managing the practice and doing the office things. And, you know, sometimes doctors are not the best business owners. They just want to practice medicine. But in the case of emergency room medicine, it seems like there are some real business reasons why these private equity firms have decided to buy these kinds of doctor practices. And there is an interesting coda to all this, which I can get to, but there actually Congress has stepped in and passed legislation that is about to be implemented that in some ways weakens the case for this kind of ownership, for this kind of medical practice.
Yeah, before we get into that, I want to talk about these staffing companies. You know, if I go into an emergency room, I assume the doctor works for the hospital. That may not necessarily be true, though. How does that work?
Yeah, so, you know, in a lot of cases, that hasn't been true for a long time. So think about an example. You go to the hospital to have a knee replacement surgery, and there's an orthopedic surgeon who is taking care of your knee, and maybe there's an anesthesiologist who is handling your anesthesia. And in most hospitals in America, neither of those people actually work for the hospital. They work for private practice companies that employ doctors, and they run their own businesses. So the orthopedic surgeon will be with a group of orthopedic surgeons, and you will sometimes get a bill from them separate from the bill from the hospital. The anesthesiologist likely works for a group of anesthesiologists, and you might get a bill from them separate from the bill that you get from the hospital. But what is different about these private equity ownership arrangements is that instead of, you know, 5 or 10 or 20 doctors in a local area who have banded together to form a private practice like your local anesthesiologist might, these are national staffing companies that are buying lots of practices all around the country. And so you have the same company that is controlling the employment of lots and lots of emergency rooms because they make these deals with the hospitals. And if the hospital needs an emergency room physician, they're going to hire one of these emergency room physicians who is employed by one of these large companies.
Okay. Am I going to feel the difference if I'm a patient, either in terms of quality of care or in billing? Is that, you know, surprise medical bill? I know you've been covering that issue, Margo, over the years. Is that surprise medical bill going to be more surprising because of these private equity firms?
So what it looks like, and I have done some reporting with colleagues, and there has been some academic research sort of backing this up, is that it really looks like a big part of the reason why some of these private equity firms have been so interested in employing emergency room physicians in particular is because it is a situation where it is, in fact, quite easy to send people surprise bills. So what's a surprise bill? A surprise bill is when you go to the hospital, and the hospital is covered by your insurance, and you think that your care is going to be covered. You know, maybe you're going to have to pay your deductible or a co-insurance amount, but basically your insurance is going to pay for your stay. But what happens is that some doctor touches you at the hospital who is not covered by your insurance, and then you get a big bill from them, often costing many, many more times than what your insurance would have paid. And then you're kind of on the hook for this big bill. That's a surprise bill. And what our reporting showed is that these large private equity backed emergency room staffing companies are pretty likely to stay out of network, to decline to make deals with insurance companies, and then to pass along bills to individual patients. They have gotten a little bit better. We did our reporting a few years ago, and since then, Envision, one of these large private equity funded staffing companies that was a particularly serious offender in this, has said that they've made efforts to get more of their doctors under contracts. But it does seem that in general, if you were treated by one of these physicians who's owned by a private equity group, you probably are a little bit more likely to end up with a surprise bill than if you were treated by an emergency room physician who was employed by just a traditional private practice.
We're talking to Margo Sanger-Katz from the New York Times. She writes about healthcare there. We're looking at private equity companies getting into the healthcare business, often employing doctors and other healthcare professionals you might run into at your local emergency room. Margo, you mentioned that Congress had passed a bill that could change some of this. What is in the works when that kicks in?
Yeah, so this bill was passed in December. It was part of a big legislative package that included a lot of COVID relief, but it also included this bipartisan bill that Congress had been working on for some time. And what that bill does, it basically bans surprise billing. So it means if you as a patient, you go to the hospital, that hospital is covered by your insurance, you're having your knee surgery, and it turns out that the anesthesiologist did not accept your insurance, instead of you getting a big bill in the mail that you have to pay, which is how it is now, potentially, you're just going to pay your normal coinsurance just the same as if you were treated by an in-network doctor. And then there's going to be a procedure where the anesthesiologist and the insurance company are going to have to duke it out behind closed doors to figure out what kind of payment is going to be made for that service. And if they can't agree, there's going to be a system where they go to a neutral arbiter who's going to hear both of their cases and decide what the payment should be. But the crucial thing to understand, this law does not go fully into effect until next year. So starting January 1st, you as a patient no longer have to worry about these surprise bills. If you go to a hospital for a service that is covered by your insurance, you don't have to worry that anyone else in that hospital is going to suddenly ambush you with a bill you weren't expecting.
This has been in the works for a while. You reported, I think it was back in late 2019, Margo, it looked like something was going to happen on surprise billing in Congress. And then there was this lobbying effort and it wasn't clear who it was coming from. What did you find out?
Yeah, this was a fascinating thing. And, you know, many of your listeners may have seen these ads on television. They were running, you know, on the Super Bowl, there was an ad about this. These were running all around the country, particularly in states where there were members of Congress who were up for re-election, particularly senators up for re-election. And these ads were basically saying, this law is going to be really bad. It's going to cause there to be no doctors in hospitals, and it's going to cause all kinds of problems. And this was what's called a dark money group, which means they did not have to disclose who their donors were. So just the ads would just say, you know, this ad was paid for by Dr. Patient Unity, but there was no information about who that was. And we did some reporting and were able to discover that, in fact, it was two of these very large private equity firms that own a lot of emergency room physicians that were funding this effort, which was millions and millions of dollars on consumer ads, also Facebook ads, direct mail to constituents telling them to vote for or not to vote for various lawmakers, depending on their support of the bill.
We have this law coming into effect, as you mentioned, next year on surprise medical billing. I know it hasn't kicked in yet. We're talking about the future here, but is it thought that this could affect the economic balancing act here that makes it less attractive for these private equity companies to step into emergency rooms?
I really think that it does. You know, when you talk to these firms, they don't say our business model is to gouge patients and that's why we are investing in emergency room physicians. They say that there are economies of scale or other reasons why they think that they can make more money than what they paid for these practices. But if you look at the finances of these two groups, it appears that their debt bonds that have been placed against these companies are declining in value since this legislation started moving. So that suggests that the market thinks that these companies are worth less than they were before this legislation passed. And again, you know, that suggests that without the ability to send these surprise bills, these companies are less likely to be profitable.
Part of the story of paying for healthcare in the country, of course, some of it comes from the government in terms of Medicaid and Medicare. Do we know there's concerns about different agencies, different institutions charging different rates for the same procedure? Do we know if that's an issue for these private equity owned emergency room groups?
Well, a really important difference between these public payers, Medicare and Medicaid, and the private insurance that lots of us have through our jobs or that we buy on the Obamacare exchange or from an insurance company, is that Medicare and Medicaid basically pay everyone the same price, and they don't really allow for this kind of surprise billing. So if you're a Medicare patient and you're treated in a hospital, Medicare basically pays every emergency room doctor the same amount for their services, regardless of who employs them. And the doctors are not allowed to bill Medicare patients for any extra charges. That's already written into law. So with this new law that Congress passed and that is currently in the process of being implemented, that really affects sort of the rest of us, people who buy our own insurance, people who get our insurance through work, who have kind of private health insurance.
In just our last minute or so, Margo, a lot of question marks here, obviously. What are you watching for, especially as this surprise medical bill law comes into effect?
Well, I am watching two things. So one, on the business side, it will be interesting to see if private equity continues to invest in doctors. I think, you know, certainly there's a possibility that they have some other business strategy that they want to pursue that makes them think that they will be better at running medical practices than doctors are. And so my colleagues and I have been keeping an eye on that, on whether they are continuing to invest in medicine and in what kinds and how they're running these practices once they buy them. And then the other thing is that this law did pass through Congress, but then there's this whole process where regulators have to figure out all the nuts and bolts of how the law is going to work. And we're very much in the thick of that right now. The Biden administration is expected to issue its first regulation kind of interpreting this law tomorrow. So I'm very curious to see kind of the details of how this is all going to work and how seamlessly it's going to work for consumers.
I'll watch for your reporting on that. Margo, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Margo Sanger-Katz, domestic correspondent at the New York Times, where she writes about healthcare. She joined us for a look at emergency rooms and why many of them are operated in effect or staffed by private equity companies.